Welcome to The Art of Construction, the podcast dedicated to helping you grow your business. Together, we'll explore the world of construction with some of the best minds of the industry. Your host, Evan Tilley, a micro-influencer and sometimes disruptor, will take you on a journey that will lead your business to the next level.
What's up, Art of Construction Tribe? Devin Tilley here, and we have so many threads coming together today, in and out of all these different moments in time and putting things together. And the main message that this podcast is a catalyst from the National Housing Supply Summit, which was held in Washington, D.C. back in March 19th, 2025. Some of the days and threads and all this coming together from that event where Dennis, Matt, and Steven, they were the co-hosts and partners facilitating that event. I personally wasn't there, so I'm going to be a kid in a candy store just like the rest of y'all listening to this conversation. And at this event, they curated 8 different theme sessions where they engaged different experts, or we call the Art of Construction Master Facilitators, across the housing value chain. And they talked about all the insights and recommendations that capture in this white paper. And I want to pause there to say the conference of all the podcasts around the AEC Integration Summit that we're putting out, we're doing the whole thing with SMACNA and all these different organizations around their white paper. And I had this aha moment last week around white papers to where a guy that went to school to just do the minimal amount of white papers to move on to have as much fun as possible, what this is becoming is this is this authority practice. And a white paper is a term for that. And I had a lot of conversations in around the happy hours of like these new kids in the candy stores coming in. And the advice I gave them is just be careful about just writing a book about everything. And you have to have this credibility to come together. And so the name of this white paper that was just released right before this podcast, and we're going to be welcoming Dennis, my co-host, and credit to him of taking the different people and the process and putting this together of meeting people and businesses and municipalities at the right time. So the name of this white paper was Federal Policy Opportunities to Expand Housing Supply. The name says it all. And now we're trying to put all these shared passions to where the Matt and Steve and our guests are super fun guys that are into real estate and, more importantly, our aligned passions when it comes to golf and getting out in the links. So at some point, we're going to be doing that and have follow-up podcasts. But how does this benefit you is really I'm going to step to the side and welcome Dennis, my co-host here that's been on many podcasts who runs the Housing Innovation Alliance, to talk about the three legs of the stool. And he's going to talk about innovation and action, and he's the guy doing that. Dennis, it's an honor to have you. Can you talk through our guests, and then we'll get into our perspectives and then get them into the podcast?
Yeah, thanks, Devin. Always great to be here and to have the opportunity to share this, kind of sit by the fire and exchange some conversation with you folks. Look, so, you know, I can't take all the credit. I appreciate the tee up, but it's really been this collaboration between a group of great guys just trying to look how we can change the housing situation that we face across the country, right? And we're going to get into some of the details around that as we get further in this conversation. But what we've done is we've kind of brought together three different core perspectives, that three legs of the stool that you referenced. And, you know, when you come from the past conversation we've had, you'll know, like, it's all about, for the Housing Innovation Alliance, we're about how do we enable that market transformation, get into the field, real world implementation, and lead the change management that needs to happen where the rubber meets the road. With our first guest, Matt Hoffman from Housing Tech, we're going to get a chance to really understand his perspective on how we work to bridge the gap from a policy perspective and how we can help to enable and optimize some of the friction points that we see in the marketplace. And then Stephen O'Connor is going to jump in and share how he's been shifted his career from being focused on affordable housing development to really helping to shape and nurture the next generation of talent within the real estate and built environment space. So within that, you know, Devin, as you mentioned, we're all about innovation and action. And this is an opportunity to capture an event that we brought together in a convening of, you know, over 300 stakeholders last month in Washington, D.C., where the feedback we received was just, it was beyond our expectations in the way that we were able to bring people together around core topics to surface some key ideas and recommendations, to your point, that now serve as a framework or a roadmap for policymakers to reference as we look at what the federal government can do, but then also how state and local governments can take initiative to roll out some of these strategies. So I'm not going to get too far in the weeds. I know Matt and Steve have a lot to share as we go through the conversation, but excited to be here and excited to share this this experience with you.
Totally. And my perspectives for this is that there is so much excitement if we really lean into that portion of it, but you got to be careful because there's so many ways you can get into the weeds of talking about what didn't work versus how do we break through the ceiling together. And that's really what, that's what Dennis inspires me when I go around the group at the Housing Innovation Alliance versus certain places you go and they just tell you how it's never going to work. And that's what we're trying to do with the Art of Construction, of bringing those master facilitators together, that we are master collaborators and like to say we're not the MFers that you think of in construction. And we have to figure out how to make public-private partnerships work. That's why, Dennis, when you made the email saying, hey, let's have this conversation, and you talked about what Matt and Steven are doing, most importantly, Matt, with working in the policy, but also Steven's passion about education and bringing the next talent up to the front of the line and get that key data from the white paper. But we all like to learn differently. For me, it's all about visual learning and storytelling. So that's why I'm excited to hear and guide and listen to this conversation from the National Housing Supply Summit and then weave those threads together, like the upcoming where you guys are coming into Colorado and taking the federal from Washington, D.C. and now having these roundtable at this Colorado meetup from the National Summit. That's what I'm most – that's my perspective. Dennis, what are some of your perspectives before we get to know Matt and Steve?
Yeah, so I think we can get into the full history of how this convening came about, and really through a conversation that Matt and I were having last summer. But when we think about housing supply, and we hear a variety of numbers around the deficit that exists out there, right? And I think this ranges anywhere from 1.5 million all the way through up to 7 million. Let's just try to internalize that a little bit. If we look at the industry that we have today and the ecosystem we've established, if we as an industry try to deliver 100,000 additional units per year, that comes out to about 60 homes per working hour, right? And then if you're going to add 100,000 each year thereafter, then it's 120, 180, 240. You get how the math works, right? So the idea here is there's some systemic issues that we need to uncover and look to overcome some of these barriers. So for me, it's always been, how do we continue to encourage and foster these ideas around how we invest in innovation? I think the home building industry invests a lot more than what we're given credit for. I think some of these things will be pointed out within the white paper. We've had them through various conversations. But quite frankly, the risk to reward ratio isn't there to advertise that you're making those investments. Now we're starting to see a lot more of that come to light through various large public home builders disclosing investments that they've made over time to build in supply chain resilience to support sustainability initiatives. And one of the things that we've done specifically that's shining a light on this is we've conducted our builder benchmarking exercise in partnership with Ivory Innovations and Professional Builder Media. And what we found last year after interviewing the top 200 home builders by annual closings is that 25% of them had a dedicated R&D function. We just got the data in from this year's research report, and we found that 32% of those top 200 now have that. So that's a significant jump, and it's exactly the kind of trend line we want to see. So what we're starting to feel is that this dedicated R&D function is actually becoming table stakes. And what we're then working towards is, well, what are they focused on? Today, we're seeing that a lot of it's on internal initiatives because, well, change management in the field is just, it's difficult. It's hard to implement. So what we want to work with them is better understanding how can we help them get into the field and get with the labor that they're organized to execute with. How do we help to support that? And I think we're at a really unique opportunity or point in time. The Supply Summit indicated some of this, the Housing Innovation Summit next month, the conversations we're having are going to highlight some of this as well. But there's a chance to really improve the product and get out ahead when the market pushes back. And I'll just reference, kind of the great financial crisis end of 2007, beginning of 2008. During that downturn, there's a number of builders and a number of product manufacturers that said they were going to double down on key product developments and solutions that they were bringing to market. Huber Engineered Wood Products and their Zip System, for example, was introduced in 2006, 2007. They doubled down. Now it has tremendous market share. Home builders in your backyard, like Thrive Homes, They've done some things where during that financial crisis, they said, we're actually going to give customers even more. We're going to use that as our key differentiator. That's going to make us sticky. And they're strong and thriving today. No pun intended. But you know, I think it's all about the importance of creating these connections. That's what we're looking to do at that convenience, what we're looking to do through this podcast, and focus on ways that we can help drive change, right? So it takes a group of us to continue to consistently be out there, bring incredible voices to the table, and as Steve and Matt, I'll share with you a little later, bring in a little bit of comedy and lightheartedness to the conversation as well. But ultimately, what we want to do is move folks from this idea of making them aware of what's available to them, fostering a level of acceptance within their organization, and then driving them towards action in the field. So that's my perspective, Devin. Excited to see where we can take this discussion today and continue on with the folks that we're going to talk to.
Awesome. Well, Dennis, thank you for aligning all of these master facilitators. Let's get in to know their story and have as much fun as possible and tie some different bullet points in along the way. What do you say?
Sounds great. Let's do it, Devin.
All right. Lock and load. Matt, what's your favorite beverage?
I love coffee. Favorite beverage. Love the taste. I love the craft culture, universality. I was fortunate to get to travel to Japan last summer. I was in a small mountain town, and instead of serving coffee in a ceramic mug or a glass, they make a cookie in the shape of a cup and pour the coffee in that. You drink it out of that, and then you get to eat the cookie. Best way to consume coffee I've ever
there
had.
There you go. It's all about making a little paradigm shift, right? And meaningful. Exactly. I love that. Tell us about the favorite place you've traveled.
Italy, without a doubt. Studied there when I was a student, have been back several times. And as someone who is a architecture hobbyist, it's amazing to be in a country that for 2,000 plus years have been innovating on construction. It's where some amazing architecture and architectural techniques can be seen, and it's just a joy to be there, and obviously to eat the food and drink
love
the wine.
Give us one story from Italy.
One story from Italy. When I was 19 years old, studying there, I was sitting on a hillside, had a few glasses of wine because it was legal to do so in Italy, thinking about what to do with the rest of my life. And as I stared out at the countryside over the vineyards, I really connected with the architecture, the land, the beauty, knew I wanted someday to be involved in building.
Well, there's a moment in time that way, and that's why I love asking those questions to get the juices flowing. What is your favorite hobby or interest outside the construction silos we're going to talk about breaking down that we passionately call the art of construction?
About 15 years ago, I became a drummer, but a hand drummer, hand percussionist. So I play the congas, the djembe, and the darbuka, which is a Middle Eastern drum. None of them do I play well, just a hobbyist.
Awesome. Well, we got to know a little bit about Matt, and we also have Steven, or Steve. Steve, what is your favorite beverage?
I'm not going to be as lame as Matt and tell you it's coffee. That's my last name is O'Connor. I drink Irish whiskey, and I'm shanty Irish, so I usually go for the Jamesons. But if I'm feeling flush, I'll go Redbreast or something like that.
I love it. So when we meet up on the golf course, we got to find a way to go get our coffee and cookies. And then after we make the turn, we'll get into the Irish whiskey. What do you say?
Exactly. If anybody handed me a cookie with coffee in it, I would think that they were already in the Irish whiskey. So I just...
All right, here we go. Tell us about the favorite place you've traveled.
Well, I've been to Italy as well, but my favorite place was a couple of years ago, actually summer 2022. I took 30 students over for a study abroad course in housing economics, and we spent 8 weeks in Ireland. And all of my grandparents came off a boat through Ellis Island, migrated up to the Bronx in New York, which is where my father was born, my mother was born, I was born there. And my mother's mother, God love her, was from County Sligo, and she lived to be almost 100 years old. I was 35. When she passed, and I was able to go back to Sligo and kind of retrace her steps, which were really, really fascinating, because my grandmother originally had her ticket to come to the United States in April 1912 on the Titanic. And so it was phenomenal. I got to go and go to a general store where she had worked for several years. And in fact, the man who owned the store was instrumental in her not going on the Titanic. He And his great brogue, he said to my grandmother, he never trusted, he couldn't trust a ship that had never crossed the ocean. And he said, so let's let Ireland keep Mary for another day. And so I was able to go back to that store, still named, it's McKim. His name was Mr. McKim. And McKim's general store is still there in a little town called Colooney in Sligo. And I walked into the store, and the first person I met, I said, hi. I said, do the McKims still own this store? And she goes, oh, yeah. She said, I'll go get them, you know. So a couple of minutes later, this gentleman came down, the 73-year-old grandson of the man that my grandmother worked for. And so I started telling him this story. And, you know, he's looking at me, and he's quiet, and he's just being respectful. And half of it, I think, is, you know, I'm 6'5", about 250. And he's looking at this big, ugly, white Irish, you know, American guy coming in, telling him this unbelievable story. And, but at the end, I said to him, I said, you know, I said, my grandmother lived to be almost 100. She had 4 children, 19 grandchildren, 32 great-grandchildren, and 6 great-great-grandchildren. And I said, and until this very moment, I said, you had no idea of the impact that your family had on my family. And by now, I'm blubbering, right? I'm just blubbering. And he looked at me and just said, you know, my grandfather was a good man. And so that was my favorite thing to do. My favorite place to travel was to go back to the old sod. And that was wonderful.
Wow. Dennis, we are in for some stories here. That is remarkable. What do you like to do outside of construction?
Well, I met my wife as an undergraduate. We met at 19 years old. That was 50 years ago. We're still... she's still my best friend. She's an amazing watercolor artist. You know, she had like a lot of folks, she had a corporate career. She worked for Mike Bloomberg for 10 years. She was the creative director for his company worldwide. And when he ran for mayor the first time, he ran as a Republican. The primary that year was on 9/11. And we had a hotel room that was reserved because, you know, I was going to go in and meet her because Mike was going to win. Nobody throws a party like Mike. And of course, you know, that was postponed. But when we were sitting in the fourth row at City Hall in his inauguration, and you could barely hear anybody talk because they were removing the World Trade Center behind us, that's when she turned to me and she says, you know, I'm done. And at the time, our kids were in high school. She goes, I want to go to the prom. She goes, I want to do the college visit. She goes, I want to do all of that, you know? So we sold our house and got an apartment in Westchester and bought a little place up on Cape Cod, which is where our home still is now. My wife started painting. And today she is just an accomplished, award-winning, published watercolor artist. And so I love going to galleries and to museums and other places to see art and to be with her. And I know that sounds hokey, but but that's it. You know,
not hokey at all. It's magical. Like the picture you just painted, Stephen, is magical. Like I think about the pre-interview when I was talking about my little Wanch golf course of the little engine that could, that I just, when I start out to just get people's attention of, I say, yeah, I'm building a golf course. And then long story short, it comes into, it's just been blood, sweat, and tears. And I've still kept it under $20,000 to build the actual golf course so far. And then you put it into perspective. And that's what you just did, Stephen, is put into perspective to say, one of my passions is being authentic. And one of the things I want to do instead of just all digitize this thing is I want to have someone come out and paint the scene of each golf course and doing a retreat with the different people of putting the art and the construction together. So maybe there's a story unfolding here, but I'm going to sit back and Dennis, let you take the mic and get to know these guys a little bit better and the problems that you're solving through Housing Innovation Alliance.
Yeah, thanks, Devin. It sounds like Devin's trying to get some free watercolors, Steve. You got to watch out for this guy.
Well, you know, if I get free golf, you know, I'm easy.
I'm giving free golf, Dennis. I started by free golf. I think there's something there.
All right, right on. All right, Matt. Let's dig into how you and I first met a little bit, right? So I know that you and I have crossed paths a number of times before we kind of kicked off the partnership for the Housing Supply Summit. Actually had the opportunity to connect with one of your one of the companies that you're an advisor to, based out of my hometown here of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And you know, through the engagement I had with them, was able to joined a session that you hosted in DC. What was that, 2020, 2019 or so? You held a conference to bring a couple of startups together in DC under your Housing Tech Ventures umbrella?
Yes, exactly. That was Housing Tech Interactive is what we called it. And it was really a precursor to what became the National Housing Supply Summit, which we threw last month here in DC. And it was based on the same principle, which was the bringing the innovation that's occurring in the housing sector to Washington, where the policymakers said, I mean, you know, housing is such a local, housing construction is such a local endeavor. Most of the policies that are put in place and enforced are at the local level. The culture of the industry is set at the local level. But here in Washington, we really set the boundaries at the federal level for what finance can do, insurance, you know, and then obviously health and safety as well, worker training, et cetera. So the industry boundaries, I'll call them, are really set here in DC. And so even 6 years ago, as I was nurturing some startup companies in an advisor role, building a small portfolio, investment portfolio startup prop tech companies, wanted to bring that exposure of those companies to DC and test the theory of, you know, would the policymakers show up to learn more about what's happening on the cutting edge? At that time, really, it was all prop tech, less construction tech for what I was focused on. And so we took a page right out of the venture capital playbook, which is if you have a portfolio of companies, you throw a demo day. It's like throwing an open house if you're a broker, inviting other brokers. The venture capital firms throw these demo days and say, hey, other investors, come look at our portfolio of investment opportunity. And it allows them to feature the solutions that they bring to the marketplace. So we did that. We were connected at that first one we did in 2019. And we've had good fortune to do a bunch of collaborations. Yeah.
So I know, I remember, like, I somehow rerouted myself from flying from Boston to Pittsburgh through DC, saw the event. And to your point, it was well beyond what I had expected to walk into. Standing room only, a few folks. You had Brian Gaudio from Module, Brian Copley from City Builder, a few others that I didn't stay as close to after the event. But I remember being so interested in kind of what you were working on that I thumbed a ride back to the Berg instead of flying back with Brian Gaudio, and kind of bent his ear the whole 5 hours back into the city. And you know, since then, we've had the opportunity through the Housing Innovation Alliance to work with Brian and his team and see some of the amazing work that they're doing. Talk to me a little bit about what led you into that kind of that focus area for your work. Why did you get so excited to work with some of these early stage companies? I know you have a kind of a colorful history or background in kind of working in the social impact space. So just give our listeners a little bit of that flavor.
Yeah, well, it really started when I started my career after graduating college. I was working in another industry other than home building that is also a innovation laggard, I would call it, and that was education. My first job was really focused on, I was teaching. I was the computer teacher at a small K-8 school, but that led to focusing on how technology is affecting education. This is back in the early 90s, pre-internet. And spent some time working on a federal report on distance learning and how we could provide the best education, the best teachers to people all over the country and all over the world, frankly. So it was that application of technology to improving, a social service, a common public good. So went off to get a master's degree focused on technology and telecommunications policy. So that was really the grounding that I had about the power of technology and innovation and applying it to problem solving for public good. So fast forward, I end up becoming an urban infill developer about 10 years later, because part of going back to that sitting on the hill in Italy and saying, you know, how do I build, a small village or a city like this that I'm looking at, admiring the architecture and just looking at how people are moving around and the beauty of the integration with the landscape. So I went to Baltimore, which is not quite like sitting on a hillside in Italy, but a great city nonetheless, that was undergoing a renaissance in the early 2000s. And I took that, the lessons I learned around technology and telecom, and now we had the internet. And as I built that business, was always looking to try and how to automate or improve and use technology as a tool, you know, not just to provide a better product, but frankly, to make more money. So that led to the Great Recession, which you referenced in 2008, and being a value-added developer was not a great business to be in 2008. So I actually joined Enterprise Community Partners, which is a national mission-driven organization that focuses on affordable housing, both from a finance perspective, but also a policy perspective. And I was fortunate at the time, Enterprise had gotten a very generous grant from Ron Terwilliger, who's one of the great philanthropists in the housing sector. He's put his money behind Urban Land Institute and the housing center that they have, over $100 million to Habitat for Humanity and tens of millions of dollars to Enterprise, among many other things, I'm sure. But anyway, he sponsored a new role at Enterprise to focus on innovation. And I was the first Terwilliger Fellow, which was supposed to be a year-long position, which turned into 11 years of leading innovation at Enterprise. So it was really that exposure and that platform to the affordable housing sector and the focus on innovation and having some resources to invest in new solutions. As I got to know affordable housing, which is, you know, the subsidized component of our broader housing value chain, I had an interesting experience, which was there was so much money going into the sector from the public side, but that was pretty much it. We weren't seeing a lot of solutions that were market-led. And at the same time, as we were kind of scrapping to get as much capital as we could, which was working through state legislatures and Congress to get these allocations for affordable housing, I was observing in the marketplace, this is around 2015, 2016, the rise of Bitcoin at the time. And then another phenomenon was that so much money was going into venture capital at the time. And so as Bitcoin went from under $100 to over $900 between about 2015, 2017, and then I read this article in 2017 in the Wall Street Journal about a venture-backed company called Juicero, which had raised $120 million to bring to market a juicer, which, you know, you put fruits and vegetables in, that was also connected to the internet. And somehow that was a worthwhile product to put $120 million into. I'm like, how come we're sitting over here in affordable housing trying to build more housing, not just for low-income people, but for the whole country, and we're scrapping to get, you know, these deals together and capital behind, and people are willing to throw $120 million into an internet-connected juicer, or make a bet on, you know, cryptocurrency that, especially in 2015, was very, very speculative. So that led me to the prop tech sector and, okay, we need to move over and make our housing investment funds, whether they're, you know, subsidized, you know, affordable, or even, you know, that workforce housing product, more investable, more attractive to people who have lots of capital and are seeking a fair return. So that's really how I got into Housing Tech Ventures, which was to create a venture fund that was thesis-driven around housing affordability and housing supply, and then supporting new solutions that were trying to support that thesis, bring solutions that could increase housing affordability.
Yeah, and supply. So it's really interesting because it sounds like, you know, you were ahead of the curve in some of that thinking, right? And since then, in 2017, you know, groups like Ivory Innovations have launched the Ivory Prize. You know, this is a privately held production home builder that has, you know, a passion for creating more attainable and affordable housing solutions by kind of looking through their three verticals of, you know, policy, finance, and construction design. I know you've had some tie-ins to their organization as well as other initiatives that are more on the from the private market are trying to drive some of this transformation, like the NHB Startup Zone, which you and I had the opportunity to kind of collaborate on in the past as well. So I think, you know, I'm just real curious, is there an opportunity to continue to enhance what these groups are doing by having them work together in a different way? Or do you think that they're kind of serving purposes in their own kind of pathways that are adding real value? I'm just kind of curious how you kind of take these different places where you're playing and aggregate them.
Yeah, I mean, first I'd say, look, there's plenty of space in this market for more people to be developing programs like Clark Ivory has invested in through the Ivory Prize. I mean, we can't get enough of people in the industry thinking about the future and using their resources. So I gave you an example of that before with Ron Terwilliger, someone who had an extremely successful career at Trammell Crow. I think I'll speak for Ron in saying, I think that career probably, I knew he grew up in public housing in Alexandria, Virginia, close by to where I am now in Bethesda, Maryland. And he understood the importance of a healthy, safe, affordable home and the transformation that can have in someone's life. And he made a lot of money and he has supported a lot of housing philanthropy throughout the decades. Clark Ivory did the same thing. And then the organization I worked for, Enterprise Community Partners, the founder of that was a developer named Jim Rouse, who's famous for developing some of the country's first shopping centers. And he too closed out his career, which was very successful with the Rouse Companies, by founding Enterprise and investing in affordable housing. So I'd say that, you know, in general, we need more people in the industry. And I think it's a very generous industry. But to focus on how to make this contribution at the systems level to invest in the next generation of people, in the next generation of solutions, and also just to work in good faith with policymakers to put in place sensible policies that allow us to build more housing while also meeting some of the other requirements that we have around environment and life and safety and durability.
So building on that and, you know, kind of really focusing on your comment around, you know, the next generation of talent, I want to, you know, kind of pivot over to Steve a little bit and talk to you, Steve. You know, tell us a little bit about your role as a professor and chair at the George Washington University Center for Real Estate Studies.
Yeah, I'm still thinking about the fact that, you know, Matt had the opportunity to buy Bitcoin at $100. So we'll start there. But I love you, Matt. I'm never going to get that coffee cookie cup out of my head. Chair and professor and chair of a real estate program. So I've been in real estate, I've been in academia a little more than a decade. My wife will tell you that when we first started dating, 18, 19 years old, you know, when we were talking about what we wanted to do when we grow up, I said, you know, I'd eventually like to get my PhD and teach. And I eventually achieved that, but I did that in my 40s, right? I did that in my 40s. It was still always a goal for me. So I went back, what I like to euphemistically say, mid-career, and got a PhD in planning and public policy at Rutgers, mostly because at that time, I had taken a slight hiatus in developing housing and was asked to become president of a community development organization. They were doing, you know, social health and human services planning in an urban community in New Jersey. And it was the most profound experience I ever had. It just, I knew how to build physical infrastructure. You know, you give me a piece of property and I can build something on it, you know, particularly housing. But I knew nothing about social infrastructure. And this particular job experience, professional experience, gave me that. I was working in urban public school education. I was doing welfare to work programs. At the time, we were executing a Hope 6 project. It was just profound for me. And luckily, the planning and public policy PhD program was at Rutgers University, just a couple of blocks away. And I was able to achieve that degree. So I knew this is what I always wanted to do at this stage in my career. And it was 2008 that Matt had referenced earlier. You know, the market was in the toity and, you know, certain things happened. And I had a chance to essentially... Well, something happened at where I was working and a new president came in. It was a small boutique little place. It was too small for the two of us. They wrote me a nice check, accelerated my stock options. And I went home and to my wife and I said, well, you know, it's time to teach. And so that's what I did and went into teaching. couple of years ago, I was recruited by George Washington, and I was teaching at the time at Bucknell University, a beautiful little college university in the middle of Pennsylvania. But it's in the middle of Pennsylvania. Nothing wrong with Pennsylvania, but you know, I'm a kid from the Bronx. I need a city. And my wife, as I mentioned, is an artist, and she needed an art community. But spent 6 years at Bucknell, created the real estate program there. And by the time I left, I absolutely created a minor in real estate. By the time I left, the minor in real estate at Bucknell was the most popular minor at the university. But I knew that, you know, I'm in the red zone. You know, it's the fourth quarter. I'm in the red zone, and I wanted to pull something, you know, across the goal line for myself. And one of the things I always had as an aspiration was to do something academically in affordable housing. I always tell people that I learned this industry through the industry. I would go to conferences that were sponsored by Nixon Peabody or Novogradic, or at the time, the Resnick Group, now the Cohen Resnick. Professionals actually teaching other professionals how to do affordable housing. And there was nothing that was available at the academic level that could really, you know, teach with a whole robust kind of a curriculum what this industry is all about. Just not only the rewards that are generated as a result of building housing for low and moderate income households, but also, you know, the tools that are necessary, the hard work that's necessary to be able to do this. And so when GW came calling, I said, listen, I'm fat and happy in the middle of Pennsylvania. I said, but here's what I really want to do. I want to create a program that's going to train the next generation to understand the challenges associated with housing, housing affordability, income inequality, homelessness. I said, because there isn't a place like that academically in the United States. And they said, well, that sounds great. And I said, well, then okay, then we got a deal. So I came here, it'll be 2 years in July. And, you know, academic institutions are, you know, they're not easily, you don't easily change them. You know, it's the turning around of that, as I mentioned before, the Titanic didn't sink, but it's hard to turn that kind of a ship around in the sea. But I have to tell you, I've been able to achieve the things I want to achieve because I just got approved a graduate certificate in affordable housing here at George Washington University, which I'm really excited about. And so, you know, that's how I got here.
That's a fantastic story, Steve. So if I understand that correctly, a certificate in affordable housing means that you don't have to be attending the university, but executives from throughout the industry can participate in that program as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the most exciting thing for me, Dennis, is that, yeah, the certificate's going to be available to any graduate student here, but it's also going to be available to anybody on the outside, the public. So if you have an undergraduate degree, and I haven't quite worked out the details yet relative to eligibility, but, you know, if you're working in a nonprofit or for-profit or you're working in the community development section of a bank, if you're in government, you know, at the municipal, county, state, federal level, and, you know, this is a space that you're in and you want to learn more about it, you can do that. You can come here, achieve the certificate. It's 12 credits. All the certificates at George Washington University are 12 credits in length. But the great thing about it is when you're successful, you'll be able to apply those 12 credits toward any master's degree at the university. So it's not, it's not time and effort and dollars that are just going to be, you know, one and done. You can go ahead and you can continue that education. So I'm really excited. You know, Washington, the other reason I wanted to come here, we are, you know, obviously the public policy epicenter of the universe. And so the ability to draw in all the different folks who are around the public policy space here in housing, from Fannie and Freddie to the government to all the other professional associations, it's a wonderful place to stand up this program.
Yeah, no, that's impressive in that you've been able to pull it together in such a short period of time. And it's that out of the box thinking and this type of outreach to galvanize the industry around these concepts and these education platforms that are so important. Can you just give us a quick snapshot of what success looks like for you over the next 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm not, I don't want to be glib, but I'm feeling pretty good. You know, I mean, what the 3 to 5 years from now, you know, one of the things I do when I talk about the certificate program to the industry here, whether I'm at a national conference or something that's local, the industry is excited. And, you know, what I've said to everybody is, well, in order for this to work, I really need your help. So I've gone to the organizations that I just mentioned relative to Cohen-Resnick and Novogradac and others and said, I need you in the classroom, right? I need you teaching students. You know, I can get all the policy stuff. I have professors here, you know, that are teaching sociology, teaching a course in homelessness, professors who are teaching about urban sustainability or community development, where they're actually teaching about tax credits, CDFIs, other types of financial institutions that are central to the development, success, and the financing of affordable housing. So what success for me in 3 to 5 years would be, me being able to look back and say, this was my capstone. You know, in 5 years, I'll be 73, 74 years old. This is my capstone. This is something that I wanted to do and I wanted to achieve. And there are students who are coming here that are not only getting prepared to meet the challenges, to be able to hopefully, you know, eliminate some of that deficit that you were talking about earlier. You know, Dennis, whether it's 1.5 million units or 7 million units, and go out there and be a force for good for housing. So to me, that I could look back and with great satisfaction if I was able to achieve that.
Yeah, well, we love that passion and that commitment you have. And, you know, I'm going to touch on this a little bit later, but I really think one of the great things that we'll see over the course of this year and just do what we've been experiencing with our network, it's kind of this codification of the wisdom and translating that into something that's actionable and workable for the current generation that's going to be taking into leadership. So I think, and you're speaking exactly to what you're doing from an academic and education perspective. So love that. You know, kind of playing a little bit off what you introduced around bringing people together, connecting the right types of stakeholders across the industry. You know, Matt, I want to have you share with us, let's go back to the genesis of this entire conversation. Let's talk about the Housing Supply Summit. How did this whole, share with everybody how this whole thing came to be and how the three of us really joined forces here to bring it to life.
Great. Before I do that, I wanted to let Steve know that while he was talking, I texted my coffee guy in Takayama, Japan, and he's the one who has the coffee cup made out of a cookie, and I have him working on an Irish whiskey shot glass, double, of course, made out of a cookie, so we'll have that ready for you in the next 4 weeks or so,
Steve. Oh, the kindling is building.
There we go. Okay, so back to the National Housing Supply Summit. So I was born and raised here in D.C. I've lived here my whole life, 2 degrees in public policy. I'm sort of committed to how public policy can be used as a tool for good. We can do great things with it. I know people, especially who live outside of D.C., love to hate on D.C., call it the swamp and other things. And, you know, it's a hard business, though, right? We're a big country, 330 million people, lots of different points of views. But one thing I've learned about all sorts of issues that get, you know, addressed here in D.C. is that there's more things we have in common than we disagree on, and or at least at the outcome level, right? People want more housing. Let's focus on our topic today of housing. People from across all different political perspectives want more housing. The industry wants more housing. Government wants more housing. Okay, so we want the same outcome. It's really about how we go about doing that, where we get a little bit lost. Not in just how to do it, but in the process, and where we lose that potential for collaboration. So in D.C., people come here, dare I say, hundreds of thousands, if not millions a year for business, representing a lot of different industries to talk to policymakers and on the Hill in Congress and also in the administration and the executive branch. You know, those conversations are important, but a lot of times they're very, very transactional. People are looking for specific solutions, and it's more of a negotiation than a conversation. So there are lots of convenings that happen here as well, trying to educate and do sort of the pre-work to get people informed about issues and understand things. And one of the things about housing policy is a lot of the focus at the federal level is really about affordable housing. And when we say affordable in I'll call it the industry, using air quotes for those of you who are listening, We call it capital A affordable housing. So capital A means that it's subsidized or regulated by the federal government in some way, supported with loans or subsidies or prescriptive regulations about how to build it. But there's also what we call lowercase affordable housing, which is housing that's affordable to anyone at any income level. In Washington, a lot of the convenings, the meetings, the education that goes on is focused on the subsidized portion, which is really the lower income element of our housing sector, which is much bigger than just serving that portion of the market, which is very important, no denial of that. But that's the two most powerful tools that are mostly discussed here in DC are the low-income housing tax credit and Section 8 vouchers. So vouchers that are used to help renters afford their rent. And those are all really important questions, and there's lots of complexities around those issues. What we saw as an absence in DC is a platform for policymakers and for the industry to talk more broadly about that lowercase housing affordability and to have a conversation about how housing gets built at the local level. And there's some things that the federal government can do, but a lot of it is implemented at that local and state level. So we wanted to create a platform where we could have a conversation where industry could bring its perspective to the policymakers in a non-transactional way, identifying where the bottlenecks are that are preventing them from building more housing and having that also understanding from the policymakers about what their limitations are, because the policymaking process in this country is very complex with lots of different constituencies that need to be served and also a time frame that is not suitable for kind of quick change. So that really was the genesis. How do we create a space where people can come together and have a conversation in a non-traditional way for how business is done in DC? So that was the genesis of the National
Thanks, Matt. And I think that the timing of everything, you know, as we looked back to last summer and, you know, starting this conversation and looking to kind of bring our two worlds together. And as we started to bring, you know, work with Stephen and bring his perspective into the conversation, it really was, we knew things were going to be a bit different, right, as we headed into 2025. At that point, we weren't quite sure which direction it was going to take from the presidential election perspective. But as that became clear and we started to set the stage for this discussion, I think that, one, it was a great time to kind of create a level set for everybody and bring, you know, create a common set of awareness and understanding to the dialogue from both of our shared audiences. So kind of curious, now that the white paper has been released, we have some core recommendations out there in the field. You know, what kind of short-term outcomes do you want to see from this convening?
Well, the short-term outcome that's most important to me is to establish new relationships and new dialogues between industry and policymakers. Shifting off that transactional relationship that typically happens in DC, where industry marches up to a congressional office and says, we want you to pass this bill for this reason for our industry. And, you know, they leave and then the next industry group comes in and makes their request. And, you know, it's a process that, you know, for better or worse, that's how it works. But there's not a lot of time, especially for the policymakers, to sit back and reflect. So in the short term, I want the National Housing Supply Summit to create relationships where both industry can have a conversation with policymakers and policymakers can have a conversation with industry about specific issues and specific opportunities so that better policy can be made and policy that's been made that needs to be unmade can be retracted. Because that's one of the biggest problems we have and that we discussed at the Housing Supply Summit is that there are a lot of good intentions to policy, but over the last 50, 60, 70 years, especially, we keep adding new regulations without reflecting on their current relevance, especially if they're historic regulations, and almost as importantly, or maybe even more importantly, how these different regulations play with each other. So if you look at them in isolation, they may seem like good ideas, but when you put them in the context of actually building a home, sometimes these regulations are actually in conflict. It could be because of timing, it could be because of process, and it could be even because of the outcome. So again, in the short term, more sunshine and dialogue, these would go a long way, I think, to having better housing policy developed.
Right on. So you really see yourself as being a bit of a catalyst for creating those connection points and this convening again to be that platform where people can have that dialogue in a safe and kind of trusting environment. And I think that's true to who all three of us are, right? We want to that dialogue that we want to foster for collective good. You know, Devin, I'd love to hand this back to you and bring you back into the discussion here and see where we want to take things.
Yeah, a few notes I just want to point out. I love how Matt said that at the end of the day, there's a lot more commonalities than disagreements. And I think it's important just to hear that right now where people are standing and that everybody wants the same outcome, which is more housing, right? That's why we're all listening to this, to help the builders and affiliates to build better buildings. And I like how you're talking about how we really have to figure out how to be broader than just these LIHTC conversations that are really can get challenging, right? And create a level set. And that's what you guys are doing with the outputs of the white paper from all the inputs at the different summits. And people making decisions, not just getting sold, like getting the next sales pitch. We have to figure out how to get educated around these sales pitches, in my opinion. And then at the end of the day, I always say we have to learn by doing, and maybe we need to do a little bit more unmaking than making to leap forward, so that when we unmake to make, that's where I kind of want to pass the baton back to Steve, that at the beginning he talked about how he learned the industry through the industry. And I can't express how important that is to show up and get involved in this stuff, because that's how we are passionate and here to articulate this. And I want Stephen to talk about that, because it's hard to change and have somebody that say, don't jump on the Titanic, do this a little bit differently. And when we get to the end, that's not for this next question, but I am super excited to hear Steve's magic wand when he says, I want to make meaningful change in the next 3 to 5 years, which is means 73 years of learning, and he wants to make this statement and answer this question at 76. So, Steve, how do we harness the wisdom and pass the baton? And what are you doing? You kind of teed up the program, and good on you, and thank you for sharing that story to get us here. But can you talk a little bit more how to educate around affordable housing and what you're doing at GW?
Yeah, you remind me of there's this saying by a gentleman named John Cotton Dana, who was actually a librarian. And his quote is, who dares to teach must never cease to learn. And so at my age, I have a lot of friends who are playing golf full time, which is great. I'm not that good to play that full time. And I just feel like I still have so much experience from what I've gone through in the industry, particularly on the affordable side. So that, as we're talking, Matt characterizes affordable as the capital A. And yet, I'm sitting here and having conversations with students and with others and saying, listen, that low-income housing tax credit program, which is the longest, most productive housing production program in the history of the United States, is really in peril, right? I said, just from the standpoint that, if corporate income tax rates go down to 15%, how is that going to dry up the appetite amongst investors to buy tax credits, right? It's hard enough now to try and bridge the gap between what a project costs and what the population you intend to serve can pay. And now all of a sudden, if we're going to be, we can't even afford to build it anymore because tariffs on lumber, steel, appliances, everything else, labor supply is gonna no amount of subsidy is gonna bridge that gap. We're forced to be able to come to the table and say, okay, now what do we do? Right? Now what do we do? So I don't have a magic wand right now. I'm be totally honest with you, I'm nervous, right? I'm really nervous. I know this is an administration that doesn't like regulation. And yet from an affordable housing standpoint, the greatest piece of legislation that was ever passed was the 1970 Community Reinvestment Act, you know, which basically was in reaction to all of the decades long detriment of what was taking place relative to redlining and the lack of capital going into low income communities. Right. So now if the Community Reinvestment Act is diluted or even taken away, I don't know what's going to happen, even though within the 40 some odd years of the low income housing tax credit program, most of the investors there, this has now become a profit center for them. Projects that are built with low income housing tax credits have a lower default rate than market rate developments. Right. So this is obviously a time of unbelievable uncertainty. And I just don't have that kind of a clear crystal ball to understand what's going to take place. We're already hearing stories about how Section 8, you know, kind of the lifeblood for millions of people just to be able to afford housing, in addition to some of the other necessities in life, is going to be cut drastically. So I wish I could be more optimistic. I just don't see it short term. I just don't see it. So the hardest thing that I do, Devin, the hardest thing that I do is stand up in front of a group of 20 or 30 students who regularly take my classes in affordable housing or in other courses and try to instill the enthusiasm into them to go into this particular side of the industry while not giving them the doom and the gloom in terms of how hard it is, how long it takes, how expensive it is, how competitive it is, and to try to balance that level of reality and enthusiasm. That's the hardest, that's almost the hardest. The other stuff I can teach, you know, the enthusiasm and the motivation to be able to have them go into this industry. If I can achieve that, then I've done well. But again, I don't want to, hate to end on that note,
I challenge you to say you're passing the baton to begin, but I think we just need to pause and say thank you for the vulnerability, right? Because there's so much people that show up and throw up and say it's a bed of roses, and then you jump in and construction is not a one sentence thing that you just preach to somebody and train the trainer, right? Like I'm going to Google the 1977 Community Reinvestment Act, and then I'm going to put that into my large language models and say, how do we break through the ceiling through the Section 8 crash? And I'm saying these words that come together, all you learn by doing, right? And so that's what this industry, you talk about how you learned the industry through the industry. You're trying to pass that baton, and it's not. You know, one of my mentors, Matt McMullen, who's the executive director for the Art of Construction, he says, Devin, every day we're trying to figure out how to run between the raindrops. And if you just sit and just try to be the next person to take over LIHTC and do it better than the past, we're in a tough spot for that because the well is dry. Where is it raining and not get squashed, right? And so the big question I think we all have for you, and it's not just you at GW, it's all of us working together to say, how do we all four of us lean in? And from your perspective, Stephen, how do we train the next generation of leaders that are going to step up and help drive affordable housing?
Yeah, well, I think it's housing in general. You know, one of the reasons why I was so happy to join Matt and Dennis in the National Housing Supply Summit discussion was, you know, housing in general. You know, how do we do more housing? You know, and that's a big deal. I've got... you know, there are so many students. I mean, it's expensive to go to school these days, you know, and yet at the same time, we look at the deficit in the labor markets. And, you know, I'm hooked on a lot of the TV shows that do construction. I'm binging right now Maine Cabin Masters, right? I mean, I just, because these are guys that all look like they could be the backup band to ZZ Top, right? But they are incredible craftsmen, doing incredible things with their hands, with lumber, with, you know, just building, electricians and plumbers and drywall and roofing, and the incredible lifestyle that you can have by being your own boss, your own entrepreneur, and contributing to housing supply. So part of my discussion with a lot of young people is, yeah, you want to get in into this industry in general, housing, there's many ways to be able to do it. Being, you know, sitting and being project manager or project developer or going out and doing it is one thing. It's also another thing to, you know, put a belt around your waist and sling a hammer. So, again, Devin, I think having those conversations, and, you know, and in between all that, it really is part of my education process is I teach how to achieve feasibility. You know, when you're sitting there and you look at a piece of property and go, yeah, I want to do 200 units of housing or whatever. Okay, so what are the financial, you know, landmarks that we have to set on? You know, the other part of that is, how do you own a house, right? How do you have a conversation with the generation that I'm talking with, who might be sitting in a classroom like I am, where the tuition is beyond my comprehension? $75,000 a year. And to think about the student loans that these kids are going to come out with. And I tell them, I said, between that, if you have credit card debt, if you own a car, if you have a car payment, et cetera, and you need 20% down, how are you going to buy a house? And more importantly, where are you going to buy it? Right? If we don't increase the supply, right? It's just going to mean, you know, you're just going to continue to drive further and further out to affordability. And then hopefully we'll still have programs around like the FHA where you get a 3.5%, you know, down. But then, you know, that private mortgage insurance or the mortgage insurance with the FHA is going to stay with you, you know, forever or until you get rid of the loan. So, again, I don't want to be the Dr. Kevorkian of housing here, you know, but at the same time, you know, believe me, if I make that reference in my classroom, my kids have no idea what I'm talking about. But at the same time, there is so much in front of us that we have to confront, where we can't be on the sidelines. We constantly have to pull through. And we have to, this is why I love this summit and the meeting of policy and industry to say, okay, enough of the bullshit, right? We know how to build, but if you look at our production over the last couple of decades, it's gone down. We haven't forgotten how to build. Yeah, how do we clear that pathway? Yeah, to be doing more. Yeah, to be.
And Steve, let me pick up on that for a second, because one of the things that came out at the Housing Supply Summit was the importance for industry not just to focus on HUD or Federal Housing Finance Agency or the Treasury Department, which manages the tax credits, which are where we get a lot of money that comes in to support affordable housing. We also need to think about the Department of Labor and the Department of Education, because the Workforce Development and Talent Supply panel so brilliantly laid out all the opportunity that the federal government can provide to support the industry with resources and incentives and even regulation. I think only 25% of Americans have four-year college degrees. So the other 75% who are constantly being kind of hit over the head with, you know, you got to get a college degree, that, you know, that's where the good high-paying jobs are. You're going to sit behind a computer. It's better work and all this stuff. We've totally misdirected, you know, several generations of Americans, I think. And we need to re-elevate not just the respect that we have for the trades, the people that go out and build, like the folks you were describing in Maine building the log cabins, but also the economic opportunity that exists. And, you know, it crosses the political spectrum again, because, you know, we can't export those jobs of building homes in America. I mean, those are going to be built here, you know, on U.S. soil. So those jobs are going to stay here. So there's so much opportunity, again, regardless of your political viewpoint. when it comes to supporting the trades and bringing new people into the trades at the beginning of their career, but also enabling people to reprogram their careers if they've been, you know, in a service industry or sitting behind a computer or doing some other job that no longer is available to them. We have a real need for that talent in the home building business, and there's a huge variety of skills that that can use that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things that came out of the summit was, you know, there's a real sense of nervousness about whether programs like Job Corps are going to be cut. You know, I mean, to be able to train the next generation of craftsmen, you know, forget about getting into the whole issue of the labor force. You know, we're again, numbers are just reality. We're, you know, in a construction labor force of roughly 12 million people, 25% or roughly 3 million are immigrants. You know, I mean, so, you know, it's hard to look at individual issues in isolation without seeing, you know, the totality and the ripple effect of various different policies and actions that are now staring us in the face. So, you know, again, it's a somber time, but I have no doubt that we'll get through it because this industry is resilient.
And well, I'm going to call it an optimistic time. And that's because I think that we've got people engaged in conversation. So regardless of where the immediate policy is given, where Congress or this administration is, I think we've got more people focused on the power of public policy, the importance of public policy, importance of being engaged. I just finished reading a book called Abundance, written by Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson. And that whole book boils down to a general concept, which is basically flipping people's perspective from a scarcity mentality to an abundance mentality. And that isn't just more is more. The most important principle coming out of the book is that the abundance agenda is about institutional reform. And that means both in the public sector and the private sector. It means taking all these institutions which have the bulk of the power in our society, whether that's the biggest home builders, the banks, the insurance companies, or government. And they've, you know, built up, we've created these institutions over decades. And, you know, they do more good, I would argue, than bad, but, you know, they have flaws like anything has flaws. And we really need to recommit to examining how we can run these institutions differently to produce these outcomes that most of us want to see. And, you know, with respect to what we're talking about is more housing. There's so much opportunity right now because people are engaged to produce those better outcomes. So that's the perspective that I have coming out of the summit, reading this book and talking with you guys today.
And here's where I want to come in and talk about eliminating the muda or eliminating the waste is what I'm hearing as I go from one summit or conference to the next. I'm not a big fan of conferences where you go to a place and they marketify it and they stand up there and show you from the marketing team the future of construction. I'm really big into these kind of conversations where you're sitting around the table talking about the good, bad, and ugly. And I'm going to pass the baton back to what Dennis is doing is taking perspectives and aligning the data with the who and the what. And as you guys are going in and out of the summit we're talking about today, I was going in and out of the AEC Integration Summit. And the joke with those guys is the TLAs or the FLAs, which stands for the three-letter acronym, four-letter acronym, and going in and out of these institutional knowledge, like the podcast I did 2 days ago in Austin with Travis Voss, who left the mechanical world and runs the Construction Dorks podcast, who's a great group of guys, that he runs SMACNA. And I was like, SMACNA, now we're into it. Like, what is that, right? And that stands for the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association. The year before that, I did Electri, which is an electrician. And SMACNA is a union-based Midwest Chicago. And it was fascinating getting his wonderful perspective of leading this organization to then having a happy hour with him at the United Lounge before we flew out. A lot of conversations in and out of that summit. And the moral of the story, why I bring this back to say, we need to eliminate the waste of so many different threads in conversation. And that's exactly why I'm honored to be part of the Housing Innovation Alliance, that you cannot innovate alone, but who should I innovate with? And that's what Dennis, talk more about the national research efforts that you're leading when you talk about jumping in and out of these riches and the niches. When you guys talk about air quotes summit, and I just talked about another summit, which summit do you pay attention to?
Yeah, well, I think you bring it, you could be a professional conference goer these days, right, Devin? I mean, there's something for everybody every day of the week. And I think it's important, you know, what we've always tried to do is kind of thread together, you know, the different organizations that are leading this market transformation, the ones that are actively engaged in kind of taking the conversation from an inspirational presentation and down into the field. So I think just to highlight some of the things that we're working on and that the team here on this, you know, sitting around the table here is focused in helping us deliver. You know, back in 2022, we partnered up with a group called the American Home Study. And this team was leading the only longitudinal data around consumer buying behaviors coming out of the pandemic. And what we decided to do was partner up to not only explore what we were learning about consumers and their changing preferences and the trade-offs they were willing to make in house and home, but really wanted to understand, once we knew who the consumer was and what they desired, what's the best way to build it? So we kind of talked about this right and left glove, if you will, of going, you know, approaching the problem is we had a consumer livability opportunity to address, and we had an industry buildability opportunity, right? So kind of galvanizing the partners around the Housing Innovation Alliance, we took that data that existed already. We conducted a third wave of the consumer study in 2023, and then ultimately built our first concept house in partnership with the group leading that to demonstrate these two proof points. In that instance, we showcased the benefits of using volumetric modular construction to achieve the desired effects that consumers were looking for. A lot of this was underpinned by elements of health and wellness that were top of mind for consumers, but obviously difficult to translate into the economic realities that they were facing as we were in this, you know, very quickly rising interest rate environment. But we took that platform, we worked with ProBuilder Media, worked with a number of other outlets, and kind of socialized this throughout the industry. And what that has evolved into is not just a single concept home built out of the study, but an ongoing exercise to both extend the study. So we are currently in market running a fourth wave of the American Home Study, which will take it from 10,000 households over the first three waves, adding an additional 6,000. So we'll have 16,000 data points from across the country and in trends and understanding, again, how consumers think about purchases made in context of house and home. And we are complementing that with a series of national focus groups to better understand region by region what is driving technology adoption, new materials, new methods, new concepts with builders and developers. So again, we can kind of take that conversation a bit further from that concept house we built here in Pittsburgh and start to understand how do we translate that into an actionable blueprint for the industry to utilize. Again, when we were showcasing the house here, the picket fence is the one that was built in Pittsburgh. It was really about kind of going from site built all the way to the other end of the spectrum, if you will, by going to volumetric modular. This conversation is about an entire breadth of solutions and technologies. It's not just focused on the production method itself. It's looking at business models, people strategies, products, whether you start from the infrastructure and work your way into the home and all the systems and technologies in it, and then also all the processes, which I've shared with you before, from dirt to dweller of community development, and then ultimately delivery and handover and operation by the consumer. So we're excited that this is a 16-month exercise that is not only going to allow us to activate the market and our network, but also keep an ongoing engagement with the occupants of the home that we built here in Pittsburgh and turning it into a bit of a living laboratory. And I know we had Dr. Balek on a call not too long ago. Her team at the University of Pittsburgh is going to be a big part of this. We're going to be sharing a lot more details over the coming months. But Matt and his team are going to be playing a prominent role in the industry side of that engagement and really digging into things. And as you know already, we're going to be in your backyard here just in a few weeks and looking forward to kind of galvanizing with your local network around some of these ideas. But maybe, you know, I appreciate the chance to share that. I know Matt, who's up to his eyes in that industry side with us, might have a few things he'd like to add as well.
Yeah, I'd just say that what I'm most excited about as we kick off this project is really to engage with the developers, the builders, the trades who are still kind of doing things the way they were taught to do them maybe 15, 20, 30 years ago when they entered the business and have not necessarily embraced new materials, new processes and innovation, and find out why. What are the obstacles? What's keeping them from creating more efficiencies or, exploring new ways of doing things, not just for the sake of doing new, but to produce a better product at hopefully at a lower cost that the consumer benefits from. Because those stories and those examples where policy can support that innovation, we want to be able to connect those folks back to state, local state and federal policymakers and resources to maybe take away any roadblocks that exist or put incentives in place that should be there to prime the pump to get that innovation flowing into this sector. I mean, we have seen so little productivity advancements in the housing construction sector relative to all other sectors. I think it is the lowest, if not the lowest, in terms of productivity gains in the last 50 plus years. And again, someone said before, it's not because we don't know how to build, but it's the process that we've developed. And it's that piece, I'll just close with saying that I think that housing seems so simple to most people who are not in the business that they don't understand the complexity of this system from start to finish. That from the initial identification of a housing project, whether it's building a single family home on a lot or a full development, to constructing that house in a family or a person occupying that home, again, whether it's single family or multifamily, is at a minimum of 3 years. And a lot can happen in that time frame. The desire to produce more housing is not something we're going to solve in the next few months or even, I'll say, the few years. It's the actions that we take now and over the next few months and few years that'll set the opportunity, the scale of opportunity that we'll have for the next decade. So a big piece of this research is helping people who have the positions and the resources, especially on the policy side, understand how strategic and important the decisions they're going to be making in 25 and 26 to solve for housing affordability and housing supply over the next decade. Because it is a slow moving machine. And once those policy decisions are made, it's going to take a while for those outcomes to be produced. So we need patience and better understanding of this complex system that we have to go from dirt to occupancy.
So there you heard it, Tribe. I keep telling everybody there is no silver bullet for this thing. The people, the three construction technologies or platform a week that reach out to me asking to be on the podcast and just say, can you help me sell this? And they're looking for the problem. Stop. And you have to figure out, you have to meet the people, the businesses and the municipalities where they are and figure out who and what. And we have to learn by doing together. So as we close in on my closing questions that I'm going to go with Matt, Stephen, and Dennis to help me close this thing out, some perspectives I took away from the summit I was going in and out of, well, you guys are going to help me wave our magic wands or a crystal ball. In the middle of the summit, everyone was talking about why we can't get anything done. And I'm going to talk about Ryan Lee, master facilitator, stood up and said, the Empire State Building was built in 13 months. And it was fascinating around the table, like, well, but how many people died? And they didn't have technology. And it was like fascinating. And then shout out to Charlie Dunn. He said, the challenge we're in right now is that it's managing and putting together these unique skill sets. He said, Ryan Lee, you're unique that you started to go to school to be an architect, but you ended up working for the first 3D printing company that made the 3D model of what was the first Nokia flip phone. So you were way 25 years ago constructing IT while you've also been a builder this whole time constructing houses. And behind the scenes, I got all kinds of stuff happening, but what we're working on, one of our big thing of this messy thing is you have to figure out the right case studies. Dennis, you talked about a great case study. One of ours, credit to credit due, you heard it on the podcast, Ryan Lee, I'll put it in the show notes, at the top of our whole presentation said Subwars with a Z. And so we're working with a few TV shows and we're doing it different ways to have as much fun as possible to meet the people, the businesses, and the municipalities where they are about constructifying the mess of constructing and having fun with the Subwars and then breaking through the ceiling. Or I think about Matt McMullen, our master. He's actually, as we sit today, he's at a modular housing factory with a developer talking about how they can do a project not using LIHTC. And he started that by 20 years ago. He is a lifelong learner. We're at Bandon Dunes playing golf. And he said, Devin, you know why I went and got my master's at the University of Denver? And this is where he was ultimate vulnerable. And I'm going to make sure, and you have to have your Matts and your Stevens come together. And he said, I was trying to pencil deals, and I had no clue how to get the deal done. And so I went to school at the University of Denver, and now I think about Dennis with Eric Holt, who's passing the baton from here to there of putting the theory and practice together. And Dennis, you made the comment of from dirt to dweller. The longer I play the great game of business, the dirt to dweller is this go-between that is the cherry on top of just actually building the case study. We're doing a whole thing. There's a bunch of podcasts coming out with Zachary Corporation where we're talking about horizontal vertical integration, meeting vertical integration, of putting the digital model or the offsite construction to the onsite construction of these different people, of their intellectual property, of what they're doing before you put in the horizontal, and then putting that connection on top. And so those are just a few things to say, Tribe, it's okay. I raise my hand and say, I don't know what to tell you, just like Stephen didn't know what to tell you. But what I can tell you, if you don't show up and get involved, you're going to get left behind. And that's what we're going to be doing in a few weeks, why I'm putting so much energy into that. And so my crystal ball is to show up to be part of the future of technology. Stephen, and then Matt, what is your crystal ball for the future with technology in construction? And then Dennis, bring that all, close that all out as we're a couple weeks away from actually meeting Matt in person. And the beauty of technology is, Matt, I think I feel like I've known you forever, and I've had a cup of coffee with you and a cookie in Italy, and I'm going to meet you in person at the and it's DOLA and all these organizations of the state of Colorado are truly now coming together to say, creating shelter for people is all of us coming together. Steve, what is your crystal ball for the future with technology and construction?
I see a great future for an IPO for a cookie coffee cup. so don't miss out on that one. Technology is, one of the things you try to do is you try to keep up with technology, particularly for somebody with my vintage, which is a nice way of saying my age. Teaching students in the era of AI is like, holy shnikes, right? The technology that's going to put forth, I'm hoping that it just gets to the point right now where I've always been, particularly on the affordable housing side, I've always been a big advocate of modular or manufactured or whatever we want to call it, right?
System built. That's what we call it.
Yeah. And so, and for the life of me, it's like the same thing I say to people relative to affordable housing. I said, if you put an affordable housing development here, cheek and jowl, next to a market rate housing development, you won't be able to tell the difference, right? And I've been saying that for a while, a long while. I think the same thing is true with modular slash manufactured slash systems. It's just, it's time has come. And, you know, the roadblocks and prohibitions, you know, in certain jurisdictions that prohibit that technology is just backward thinking. So AI is, I used to have an economics professor way back, you know, when I think he knew Adam Smith, but the, you know, he used to say, you know, the future and technology, you know, are going to take care of a lot of issues. And that was back in the late 70s. And, you know, it was scratching your head. I had no idea what he was talking about. But, you know, in retrospect, it's he was right.
My crazy question I've been asking for 12 years on over almost 400 podcasts is starting to be like, well, that's a question worth asking, is what I heard from you, which I appreciate that the Dennises and the Devons of the world continue to lead these platforms. Matt, how about you? What is your crystal ball for the future with technology and construction?
Yeah, so my crystal ball is really on the people side of the technology. I think what I was talking about before, what we've seen in the political and policy arena of so much discord, has more people now engaged in the conversation. And I think that helps us see what the art of possibility is. And there's going to be more collaboration and discussion that will unlock the innovation that technology can bring to the sector, you know, across the full value chain, from construction to finance to occupancy to maintenance, et cetera. You know, we've seen how technology can transform other industries. And I think we're really on the cusp of that. And that barrier that we faced, which is the traditionalism of home building, that has kind of held us back, compounded by what I'll call the arterial sclerosis of regulation, of just adding more and more requirements or limitations of how you can do things. We've reached the point where I think we've got enough people at the table who are in the right seats who can actually make the change to unlock that potential that technology will bring to the sector. And that will benefit the industry in terms of its ability to function profitably. It'll benefit homeowners in terms of their ability to access housing that's affordable to them at all different income levels. It'll benefit the environment because we'll be building using fewer materials and safer materials with less waste. It'll benefit our general health. I'm really excited and optimistic because I think the people that we need at the table are having the right conversations. It's going to take a little bit of time, but that's, I think, the key ingredient that we've been missing over the last decade to really allow technology to do its thing for the housing sector.
Dennis, how about you?
Yeah, thanks, Devin. These haven't changed much since the last time you and I talked, but I'm gonna reinforce a few, and I'm gonna add one new one in there. And I think it really expands on a lot that we've talked about over the course of this conversation today. You know, one, I think because of what we're seeing at the federal level, we're gonna see a lot more state leadership, governors stepping up, leading strategic supply side programs like what we saw in the state of Colorado. What we're starting to see success with. So groups coming in, establishing the incentives and the platform to scale existing systems built solutions, alternative materials and methods, if you will, to the ability to relocate and launch some of these businesses. So I think one, that's gonna be an interesting path to continue to follow. And then obviously the complement to that is the demand side policy that has to be matched up with it. I think another one, and I referenced this with Steve and some of the work that he's doing with the university, I think this codification of the wisdom from within the industry is going to be really important. I think as we have folks kind of moving on to the next stage of their lives and in looking to enjoy retirement, there's a lot that they've developed and that is embedded within them, but hasn't necessarily been systematized and translated across all of the different divisions. So I think of platforms that, you know, you look at what On3 is doing from a training perspective and Their ability to take standards from a variety of builders, building product manufacturers on installation, and get that into a tool that sits in your pocket, right? The mobile phone that we all carry, and allows folks to be, kind of be much more in front of what they're doing in the field, and then supervision that supports that. And and ARX is another one that looks more at the acquisition and data feasibility side of, or the project feasibility side of things. And again, how do you kind of take what's working, the best practices across any specific division, and then roll that out across entire organization? So I think as we go back to those numbers I mentioned earlier, and we look to scale, you know, 100,000 additional units a year or 60 more homes an hour, it's these kind of platforms that are going to take what's worked over generations and what's been tweaked and lives inside the head of a lot of these leaders and gets it into the hands of the next generation. I think another one that I'm particularly interested in right now too is this transition from kind of the idea of mega factories into more micro factory solutions that are localized to solve for delivering, you know, advanced building systems or systems built housing solutions in you know, a more localized approach. So that's one that we should certainly follow. And then I think driving all three of the areas that I just referenced, you know, is the continued influence of foreign capital, both institutional and venture, and how that's going to shape our business landscape over the coming years. Because I think we're going to see a lot more inflows based off of models that have proven themselves out in Europe and the Far East, and how that impacts, again, both established and early stage companies here in the U.S. market.
Very well said. And I would say that's why we keep pushing and coining this systems built construction and figuring out the negative of negative, positive, whatever side of the fence. And when you say the word modular manufactured, it's how does your kit of parts fit into the next generation of algorithms and large language models that become AI, and then getting more people excited to jump back in and be part of actually constructing these better built buildings in a faster way. That's what how I would articulate that, but we continue to learn by doing and niche in of where we are today. And that's why we always ask this question of Stephen, Matt, and then Dennis, bring us home. What is that one thing you want to leave our builders and affiliates to think about to go out there and crush it and grow their business? Steve?
Well, that's a really good one. I'm so focused on the educational piece, Devin, you know, that, I think that, you know, constantly trying to support younger employees to learn more and more about the business, about policy, about processes, about techniques, about advancements, you know, just constantly, instead of getting, you know, I see a lot of my students, and I help a lot of my students get jobs. And you know, one of the things that they're all looking to do when they come out is to be not only successful, but productive and things of that nature. And I always try to say to them, you know, go work for somebody in the industry who's going to be a mentor, not somebody who's going to look at you as just an Excel jockey, you know, but somebody who's going to teach you the industry and teach you the business from a financial, a moral, an ethical standpoint, you know? And so if we continue, you know, Matt is the champion of optimism. And, you know, right now I'm just hoping that, you know, as an industry, we continue to evolve and innovate and support and mentor. The enormity of the challenge that we have in front of us right now in terms of the deficit of housing just requires all of us to work together and to think differently. I don't know if that says anything or means anything, but again, I'm just so focused and stuck in the education of young people and trying to inspire them.
I love what you're saying. Like what I heard from you is like be a mentor and be willing and vulnerable to reverse mentorship.
Yeah.
And that's key to break through the ceiling, because there is so many holes in this thing that we have to flip upside down.
I mean, I have friends of mine that who were my bosses 30, 35, 40 years ago when I first came out, who are still in the industry or are still great friends because, you know, they taught me a lot. They allowed me to learn. You know, that's a big thing. Allowing me to learn, allowing me to fail, allowing me to make mistakes and learn from those mistakes. But more importantly, they were great role models, you know, and I learned more about who they were and what they were for them as human beings than as anything else. So it just, there's a lot on the industry right now, but leadership.
Yeah, and the world that you're talking about, there's a lot at stake too, right? When things go wrong or change, it can be catastrophic. So it's scary stuff that you have to be vulnerable and strong to lean into. So Steve, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story. Matt, what's the one thing you want to leave the Art of Construction Tribe builders and affiliates to think about as they go out there to grow their business?
Yeah, I would just encourage people to be as generous and generative as they can be. This industry needs as much leadership as it can get, and it's not just from the CEOs of big corporations. It's from, you know, an electrician who has a small shop. It's a framing company, a cement company. Wherever you sit in this sector, I just encourage you to adopt that mindset of generosity and to be generative. And by generative, I mean be a problem solver and a sharer of that solution. Earlier, I mentioned some great folks from this sector, the Ron Terwilligers, the Jim Rouses, the Clark Ivories of the world. Yes, they all made a lot of money, but they also gave a lot back. And you don't even have to have made a lot of money to give a lot back. So I think our future lies in this sector, this industry, coming together, not always agreeing on the solution, but having an honest and, as you've said before, vulnerable conversation, and not demonizing people. When you disagree with people, do it respectfully, but offer solutions. I mean, we need people to come to the table with better ideas, implementable ideas, but also that spirit of fellowship and collaboration.
I love it. Thanks so much for sharing your story. Dennis, thank you for creating these connections and putting us together. Bring us home.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm just going to have to echo what Steve and Matt said. I think they both nailed it. It really comes back to, you know, this willingness to create connections, to share the journey and the experiences, and then really be vulnerable in that process, because that's where the real learning is going to happen. So I think that authenticity around that path, and, you know, look, we all may have different resources, different starting points and different endpoints in mind, but there's a high probability that we're taking a similar path at any given point in time as somebody else that's already successfully achieved it, learned some hard earned lessons, or could also use some of those, have a shoulder to lean on during this. So I think it's just all about that exchange and that informal kind of support, if you will, that we can get from one another as we continue to move the industry forward.
I love it. Guys, thank you so much for sharing your story. Make sure you check out the show notes, white papers, events, so many exciting things from this fireside chat, and so much knowledge and so many things to move forward. Make sure you get involved, join the Master Facilitator community, and have as much fun as possible. Crush it out there, tribe.